Today on Maine Calling, changes in the Gulf of Maine. For years now, we've known that the water in the Gulf of Maine is warming at an alarming rate, 3 times faster than most other oceans. That data is largely based on ocean surface temperature readings. But then last year, a new report showed that deep water in the Gulf of Maine appears to be getting colder and fresher. What's going on? And what does that mean for the ocean ecosystem? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, leading marine scientists join us to discuss changes in the Gulf of Maine. Water temperature is important for sure, but they are also seeing other changes as well, including in water pH and new species moving into the neighborhood. The Gulf of Maine, next on Maine Calling. That's just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downeys communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The Gulf of Maine is ever-changing. We'll find out how rapidly, in what ways, and what it all means for the marine ecosystem and those who depend on it. Joining me today, Janet Duffy Anderson, who is Chief Scientific Officer at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, Damian Brady, Professor of Marine Sciences and Director of the Darling Marine Center with the University of Maine, and Nick Record, Senior Research Scientist and Director of Ecosystem Modeling for the Tandy Center for Ocean Forecasting with the Bigelow Laboratory for Ocean Scientists. We invite you to join the conversation. What are your questions about the health of the Gulf of Maine? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. As I read your names and your institutions, I'm reminded about how lucky we are to have so many wonderful top caliber institutes right here studying the Gulf of Maine. I know that we're lucky, and not every place has what you all represent. So thank you so much for joining us. And I want to start with you, Janet. When we talk about the changes in the Gulf of Maine, one of the first things we all think about is the warming waters. People have heard over and over again for the last decade now that Maine has the fastest warming waters in the world, more so than 99% of the oceans. Why is this happening?
Hi, thank you. Great question. So in the Gulf of Maine, we are uniquely situated at the confluence of two important currents that occur just off of our continental shelf. The Labrador Current, which is a current that flows from the Arctic, from Greenland, southward, and the convergence of the Gulf Stream, which is a current that flows from the south to the north, and they converge off of the Gulf of Maine. What we've been seeing with warming is a kind of a difference in the proportion of the contribution of water from those two streams. We get cold water from the Arctic flowing current, and we get warm water from the Gulf Stream. So that the Labrador Current, which is the one that comes down from the Arctic, that has been, over recent years, contributing less and less cold water to the system. And what we've been seeing more and more is an increase in the contribution of warm water from the Gulf Stream. The Gulf Stream has been expanding in width, and so therefore kind of coming up closer to the coastlines that we have, and the contribution of the volume of cold water from the Labrador Current, the Arctic-derived current, is becoming less and less over time.
And it's interesting to me, Janet, because we hear about the glaciers melting. It seems counterintuitive. It seems as though there might be more cold water coming.
Indeed, there are some differences in terms of input from melting glaciers, but we're also seeing differences in contributions from the warm water current as well. And so what we're seeing is a greater contribution of warm water from the Gulf Stream relative to cold water from the Labrador Current.
All right. Well, Nick, your job as an ocean forecaster is to actually measure the water temperature and create models. And there was some big news last year when you found that down deep, the water's getting colder. Tell me what you found, what you think it means. It looks as though, Nick, can you hear me? Looks like we've got Nick frozen on Zoom there. So I'm going to come back and talk about Nick's work, and I'll turn to you, Damien. And I'm wondering, as we talk about water temperature, what does this mean? What does this mean to the ecosystem to see changes in water temperature? I'm going to try that again. Nick, Damien, if you could ask, can you all hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, great, great,
Yes.
wonderful. I'm
Thank you.
sorry about
Thank
that.
you.
Yeah, Damien, why don't I have you answer that question, which is before we get Nick back and have him talk about his research, why does it matter so much? Why are we talking about ocean temperature?
You mentioned earlier, Jennifer, that there was that we're incredibly lucky to have so many great institutions along the coast here. And there are 3,500 miles of tidal shoreline along the coast of Maine, and it's just a crucial piece of our economy, right? I mean, there's hundreds of millions of dollars in the lobster fishery alone, for instance, and we have aquaculture production within the state. We're one of the top marine aquaculture states in the country. So we just have a lot riding, whether it's culturally or for tourism, economically, riding on some of the marine resources that we have along the coast. And so a changing temperature means a changing distribution and types and composition of species, potentially more blue crabs, for instance, right? That's something we're doing right now. And we're trapping more blue crabs in the Damariscotta River estuary in the mid coast of Maine than ever before, right? And 4 or 5 years ago, we were seeing it in Wells in southern Maine. And then 2 or 3 years ago, Manomet was seeing it in Casco. And now we're seeing it in the Damariscotta. So we can actually start to observe this change in distribution as it sort of moves up the coast.
So is the change, that's a good question. We have talked a lot on Maine Calling about green crabs and how destructive they are for other species. Is it because of warmer water, or would they have been coming anyway?
Yeah, so green crab's such a big topic, right? And we know that that's an invasive species, but invaded, from the 1800s, right? So it's been here a long time. I think, most of the theories around why green crabs have exploded so much, is related to less severe winters, right? We used to have winters that would really beat back and decrease the population of green crabs, and now with milder winters, green crabs sort of don't have that pressure. One interesting thing we're, anecdotally initially seeing is that areas where you start to see blue crabs are actually starting to be times where you see less green crabs, right? So we may have a sort of a succession event as these places become even warmer.
All right. Well, Nick Record is back with us. And Nick, I want to talk about your research and especially what you found last year that although the measurements near the ocean surface have been warming over at least the last 12 years and maybe longer, what you're finding is in deep water, something different is going on. Explain what you found and what you think is going on.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Jennifer, and thanks for having us. I love that you gave a shout out to how great Maine is as a place to work in on the ocean and ocean science. I feel like Damien mentioned, I feel really lucky to have grown up in Maine and like be able to do this kind of work here. So yeah, we've all heard a lot about the rapid warming, 99% faster than 99%. And if you go back to the year 2013, this is the year that kind of we, the scientific community, first noticed that. And we noticed it in the satellite sea surface temperature measurements. It was like off the charts warm for a whole year, kind of looking like what we expected the year 2100 to look like. And we all got together and had this really amazing meeting where people were talking about like seahorses and lobster traps and all these, you know, puffins not able to find the fish that they need and so on. And as the kind of the years have gone since then, it's still been really warm. But one of the things that I noticed is that that warm water that we saw in 2012 showed up in the deep water buoys about a year and a half before that. And if we had been paying attention, we might have been able to pick up that signal a lot earlier than we did. And so ever since then, I've been looking at those deep water buoys and, you know, trying to see, like, can we get an early clue as to what's going to happen next? And sometime last fall, like I want to say October or November, the deep waters, which has still been running like piping hot, it's an exaggeration, but, you know, really that same, you know, faster than 99%, et cetera, they dipped back to their long-term mean temperatures. So like basically colder than it had been since before the heat wave started. And it stayed like that for the last 6 or 8 months. It's still like that. And it's starting to creep up into shallower and shallower waters. So when I say deep water, I'm thinking about like maybe more than 200 meters or 600 feet. That's where, so Janet talked about these two ocean currents that meet outside of the Gulf of Maine. One of them is this, the one that comes from the Arctic, comes into the Gulf of Maine as what's called Labrador slope water. It's colder, it's a bit fresher than the Gulf Stream water, and that's what's coming in through the deep water. And the last time we had that kind of water in the Gulf of Maine, things were really different. We had right whales feeding here a lot more. We had right whale food, which is tied to the right whales, these little crustaceans called copepods. If people are driving down the road listening to this, they might not know what copepods are, but if they've ever swum in the ocean, they've probably swallowed them. And those copepods are right whale food. And they tend to come in from these colder, fresher, more Arctic waters. And that's what we're seeing. Bottom temperatures are also really important for lobsters and kelp communities. And like, I don't want to say that we're going back to a colder Gulf of Maine. This, you know, the long-term trajectory is still going to be warm. But a lot of people think about warming as just a one-way ticket. And we still have to keep our eyes open for temporary swings back into conditions that maybe we haven't seen in a while. And that's Damien, what's happening this summer.
It's so interesting, Damien.
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly add, right, because I think a couple of metrics that we look out for are getting colder in the Gulf of Maine, right? Which is sometimes a tough story to tell, because we are going to have these periods where it gets colder for some period of time and then warmer. And you know, the way I learned about it was a lobsterman, right? We have 5,000 licensed lobstermen that are out on the water a lot. And a Chuck Bennett, a lobsterman, actually was looking at some of the buoy data and sent it to me and said, hey, what's going on? Which is really cool. You know, I think sometimes the do your own research has been co-opted as a bad word, but it's been really fun to see 5,000 licensed lobstermen who really care check these buoys and then send them over to researchers like us and say, what's going on? And we did see last year probably the best lobster recruitment that we've seen in 8 to 10 years. So these brief periods of cold spells could be really good for industries like lobster, and it's going to sort of be embedded in a larger warming trend. But, you know, we're going to have these periods where it can get colder.
Oh, and so interesting. And Janet, I was going to ask you about that. Like, when you have swings in water temperature, how does that affect the lobster and other fish and other marine creatures? And I was thinking, oh, negative. I mean, how hard is it? It would be hard for species to deal with that. But Damien's suggesting that actually maybe some years like that might help boost the population.
Yeah. So that we do have instances where we have swings, returns to colder or previous conditions. What really sort of sets the stage and makes the difference is whether or not we have back-to-back or stanzas of cold or multi-year warm conditions. What we've seen in the past, in the recent past, is we've had a stanza, multi-years of warmer than average conditions. And that really sets the stage for ecosystem-wide changes in food web dynamics, shifts in species distributions. It's encouraging that we're seeing potentially a change back to cooler conditions. But what really is going to make the difference is if these cool conditions persist over one winter, over two, or even over three. That's when we'll start seeing, you know, real changes in productivity. And that bodes very well for our local fisheries and aquaculture resources.
Interesting, because we just talked about ocean temperature, but there are other things we haven't talked about. We haven't talked about the changing pH. We haven't talked about sea level rise. I'm going to turn to you for that, Nick. What can you tell us about the rate of sea level rise here and whether it's changing at all? Is it slowing or accelerating?
I think so. Sea level rise is not my area, I'll say. That GMRI has been doing a lot of work on this, but I do have one perspective that I would share, which to me applies to a lot of the ocean variables that we look at, including pH and sea level and even temperature. I think psychologically, a lot of us think about the change in Gulf of Maine or any climate change as a slow, gradual process, or even a fast but steady process. And that what that overlooks is basically that as that process is happening, there are still like these sudden jumps that could be up or down. And we sort of saw a case of that with sea level rise this past year, where yes, we have the background rise that's happening. And it sort of feels like, okay, if sea level rise is like the filling of a bathtub, I can gradually just kind of step back and, you know, adjust to it as it comes. But it doesn't really work like that. If you take into account those sudden ups and downs, yeah, you have the like the slow rise of the bathtub, but then you have a big storm that lines up with like a high tide and so on, and you get a really big jump all at once. And a lot of the changes that we're seeing, like the heat wave in 2012 was like that as well, is that we have to shift our thinking to expect these sudden changes to be superimposed on the long-term trends that we see.
All right. Janet, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer. I'd be happy to also kind of chime in on the sea level rise question. So contrary to kind of what people may think about when you hear about, for example, a warming Arctic and loss of sea ice and melt, most of the contribution to sea level rise is not necessarily from that. It's due to thermal expansion. So warmer water takes up more air, more space than cooler water. And so most of the change in sea level rise that we're seeing is driven by heat and thermal expansion. That's a consequence of heat. To Nick's point, we are seeing some very dramatic changes in sea level rise, but that's also sort of tempered with understanding a little bit about our coastlines and where sea level rise tends to be amplified. So we have a very diverse coastline with a lot of, you know, kind of nooks and crannies. It's very jagged. And in some places, sea level rise can be amplified if that water is being funneled through a narrow area and then, you know, kind of comes up on our shoreline. And in others, it's mitigated by the presence of, for example, marshes or mudflats. So to Nick's point, these can be events that are exacerbated through storm and confluence of storm and tides. And they can also be mitigated by some of the properties of the land masses where these increasing sea level rise phenomena are manifesting themselves.
Damien.
I just wanted to add that, you know, a shout out to Maine's Climate Action Plan, which is out, and the Science and Technical Subcommittee put out a report, and they're recommending the state of Maine prepare for 1.5 feet of sea level rise by 2050, and I think 3.9 feet by 2100. So I guess I always suggest to people when they're thinking about it, like, you know, put your local map on the coast and sort of see what does 3.9 feet really look like, because it's significant. I'm here in Stonington right now, and you can tell that would be a very significant sea level, you know. So I think just to try to put that in perspective, because maybe 1.5 feet doesn't seem like a lot, but it's quite a bit, you know, at these, especially in these nearshore coastal areas.
And just to be clear, when somebody says 3.9 feet, what they mean is that the high tide mark will be 3.9 feet higher, correct?
Right. Yeah. So that the whole tide, you know, the tidal amplitude is unlikely to change, but rather the whole tide starts to move up. Yeah.
Yeah, we do need to take a quick break. We're talking about changes in the Gulf of Maine. What are your questions? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a quick email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What do we know about what's happening in the Gulf of Maine? With me, Damien Brady, professor of marine sciences and director of the University of Maine's Darling Marine Center, Nick Record, senior research scientist and director of ecosystem modeling with the Bigelow Laboratory for Ocean Sciences, and Janet Duffy Anderson, chief scientific officer with the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now is Ben Martins, who is executive director of the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association. Thanks so much for calling in, Ben.
Pleasure to be here with you.
You probably heard just a little bit ago Damien talking about hearing from lobstermen about the changes in the temperature of the water down deep. And I'm wondering, I heard it said one time that sometimes scientists see the ocean as a slideshow and fishermen see it as a movie. And I'm wondering what you're hearing from those fishermen who are out on the water every day about the kinds of changes they're experiencing.
Yeah, no, I love that connection of a slideshow versus a movie. And I think that one of the problems that we have, though, is that movie is getting less and less clear, right? We have a lot more uncertainty from day to day, from week to week, from year to year. And one of the things that we hear back from fishermen often is, you know, we have management that is very strict in its rules, regulations, accountability, and it's needed to be in order to be rebuilding our fish stocks. But we don't always have the data streams that are being fed into our programs to reflect what we know about the ocean as it's changing so rapidly. And I think that that's a big gap right now, is that what fishermen are seeing is changing really quickly. And a lot of times the data that we need to make informed decisions lags behind. And so there's some big gaps right now between what's happening out on the ocean and then how we manage it close to shore.
So, Ben, why don't you just tell me, broadly speaking, what kinds of things are fishermen seeing that they're worried about, and what kind of things are they finding promising?
I mean, they're worried about business stability. When you're thinking about a fishing business and you're thinking about how you finance a permit or a boat or make investments in shoreside infrastructure, and it's unclear what species might be available to you or how stable the future of those fisheries might be, both for good and for those that might be shifting out of the Gulf of Maine, that's really hard. But there is optimism too. Like, we are seeing the scallop fishery moving into the Gulf of Maine. There's other fisheries that are opportunities here. And we're seeing fishermen asking big questions as well. So we actually just started a project. We got some funding and we're working with the Ocean Data Network. Coming back to one of the other comments about, like, we don't have a lot of data about the bottom of our ocean, but we're catching things on the bottom of our ocean. And so we're outfitting a number of our mobile vessels with sensors to collect bottom temperature and dissolved oxygen so that fishermen can now start being data collectors and then looking at that and reflecting on what they're catching, what's happening in the ocean, and then feeding that data into models so that we have more certainty when fishermen are making business decisions. And when they're thinking about what might be showing up as it gets warmer, what types of species are showing up in the warmer climates on the bottom versus the cooler ones that we're seeing. And so trying to give fishermen more capacity to make informed business decisions is where there is some hope right now for our fishing fleet, is giving them the data and the understanding so that they can make smart business decisions, and working with our scientific partners to help inform those as well.
Yeah, and let me just ask you quickly, you mentioned scallops, that fishermen are seeing more scallops. One of our guests has already mentioned blue crabs, more blue crabs in Maine. What are there other species that we're seeing more of that have a market? And are there species that have been very important to Maine that are going to have, in your view, less of a market in the near-term future?
Yeah, I mean, that transition is incredibly difficult to know when a fishery is moving out of an area and when a fishery is moving into an area. There are certain species right now that we're seeing a lot of in the Gulf of Maine, like flounder for our groundfish fishery. And that might be because of the cooler waters that were mentioned earlier in the show. But we lost our markets for flounders. And so we have fishermen that are catching these delicious flatfish in our ocean, and then there's no market to sell them into. Same with squid. We have there's squid that show up as the water gets warmer. We don't have the permits for squid in Maine right now. And so when they're here, fishermen can't go out and catch them. And so it's those types of gaps where you're saying, we see these opportunities. We have pollock, we have hake, we have flounder, squid, crabs. How do you have the permits? How do you have the equipment? And then how do you have the markets? And how do you move those things around quickly enough to take advantage of those opportunities when they are presented?
Well, Ben, thank you so much for calling in and offering the perspective from the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association. That was Ben Martin's really interesting perspective. And Janet, one of the things you wanted to sort of really make clear today is that this is not only a bad news story.
Yeah, we don't, you know, we hear a lot about warming. We know that fisheries populations are shifting. We know that, you know, fishermen are having to go farther in order to catch wild-caught fisheries. We know the effects of warming on, for example, harmful algal blooms. But we don't talk a lot about the potential for resilience of Gulf of Maine. And I think it's worth just, you know, making your audience aware that the Gulf of Maine does have significant resilience potential. It doesn't mean to say that the changes we're seeing, are not going to happen. There will be differences in the Gulf of Maine. But, you know, just to use one example, the Gulf of Maine is extremely heterogeneous in its seascape. It's glacially scoured. And that means that there's a lot of, differences in kind of what the bottom topography looks like. There are deep water pockets. There are shallow areas. There's a lot of heterogeneity built into the system. And where we have heterogeneity, we have the potential for refuging. So, for example, there will be, because there's deep water in Gulf of Maine, there will be, where there's deep water, there's colder waters. And so these colder waters offer refuging for cold water or cold affinity species like lobster and some of the other cod and some of the other iconic species that we have in Gulf of Maine. That's not to say that we won't see heat-mediated changes. Certainly distributions are shifting, populations are shifting, timing of events are changing. But there is potential in Gulf of Maine to continue to have lobster, to continue to have cod. And that's different from some other areas that lack that heterogeneity. For example, if you think about kind of the Middle Atlantic region or off North Carolina on the Outer Banks, where the bottom is very homogeneous, it's very flat, then what you see in those cases are warming from bottom to top in the water column. And so there's very little potential to refuge. There's very few places to go because the whole water column is heating and warming uniformly. Gulf of Maine is different in that it is heterogeneous and it has some differences and pockets of resilience in it.
And I want to turn before we forget to talk about this. Damien, so much concern about ocean acidification. Tell us what we know today about the changing pH in the Gulf of Maine.
Yeah, so I'll just say that, as we put more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, that, you know, necessarily means there's more carbon dioxide in the water, which is going to decrease the amount of calcium carbonate available to organisms that form shells. And as you might expect, a lot of our marine resource economy in the state are dependent on animals that form shells, right? Whether that's oysters or clams or scallops or lobster, right? So this is a huge, huge topic of concern for us, you know, where we're sitting in the Gulf of Maine. The Gulf of Maine already sits in this area where it's difficult for organisms to put on shell because the colder the water, there's actually less calcium carbonate in the water. The other concern that has been brought up for acidification is increased rainfall. So fresh water is lower in calcium carbonate too and higher in acidity. And Janet made an excellent point. You know, we are resilient, right? Both our coastal communities as well as these ecosystems. So, for instance, one of the concerns is that oyster larvae won't develop well under acidified conditions. And one of the ways that we can be resilient to that is we have hatcheries that grow baby oysters and then buffer their seawater and increase the pH of the seawater and then sell that seed. So there are ways of moving forward with this. The best we can do right now, though, is track it. We've mentioned buoys multiple times in this conversation. When the Gulf of Maine Ocean Observing System got deployed in 2000, we had 10 to 15 buoys. Today we have 5. And I talked to The Maine Lobstermen Association, former president Dave Cousins, he says, I check buoy F every day, which is the buoy in Penobscot Bay, for instance. And so I think getting more observations out there instead of less over time. Ben made an excellent point. Fishermen are fantastic platforms. They're going out there every day. If we can get more sensors in their hands and get that back into decision-making context where we can make better decisions, that's going to be really big too. So acidification, still a concern, still something that isn't going to go away unless we reduce carbon dioxide, but there are ways to be resilient to this change in the future.
Thank you. Calling in now is John Bradar, who is executive producer of a new three-part NOVA special series, Sea Change, the Gulf of Maine. Thanks so much for joining us, John.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So our topic today is very much in sync with the project that you're working on. Tell us about that series, Sea Change, what it's about and how it came about.
I'm more than happy to do so. So it looks at the Gulf of Maine through a climate lens, but it does that by looking at the natural history, the human history, and what's going on in the Gulf right now. So things that Janet and Damian have referenced are kind of made visual in many of the sequences in the film. So, for example, talking about glacially scoured, there's a whole animated sequence that talks about how the Gulf of Maine was formed and how that creation process led to remarkable bounty. There's discussion of change, no question about it, and how that variation that Janet was referencing comes into play with lobsters moving into colder water and, a variety of other species making their way into our warmer coastal waters, like green crabs. And as far as acidification goes, we get into, questions around mussels and their ability to form shells and whether or not they might be able to do so better in the middle of a kelp farm. And so there's lots of interesting stories, people stories, about how change in the Gulf is impacting all of us. And I also live on the Gulf of Maine. So it's all pretty relevant to the listening audience.
John, let me ask you this. As I know, often when you go into a big project, a big documentary project, there are surprises. Your mind is changed about some things. And I'm wondering if you experienced any of those working on this project.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what we all experienced, and this was a big team, and the production spanned, 4.5 years. I think the resilience of people who live along the Gulf of Maine, past and present, is something that is constantly surprising. That's one thing that really sticks out. I think the resilience of the animals that live in the Gulf is another one that's really striking. Also the novelty with which both human species and, other animal species have exhibited in adapting to what's going on in the Gulf and what has gone on in the Gulf. So those are the things that really stand out. I think one more thing that I would mention is that, over the history of the Gulf, there's been a huge amount of innovation and entrepreneurial approach. And I think one thing that gave us a surprising amount of hope is how that spirit has not gone away, that people are trying all kinds of interesting things, whether it's, farming clams or, kelp farming or, starting entirely new businesses like in the river eel business, Elvers and such. It's just amazing how much entrepreneurship and innovation is ongoing here.
All right. Tell us when the series starts on PBS.
So we premiere on Maine Public on Wednesday, the 24th of July, and then the two succeeding Wednesdays, the 31st of July and the 7th of August, all at 9 p.m. in the Nova slot on Maine Public.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in. That was John Bradar, who is executive producer of a new Nova series, Sea Change, the Gulf of Maine. And there'll be a special screening of Sea Change on July 26th. at 7 p.m. at Hannaford Hall. We do have some email questions coming in from our audience. You do have time to send some more. That's talk@mainepublic.org. You can also give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, and our topic today, changes in the Gulf of Maine, how and why they're happening, what impacts they are causing, and what is being done to protect the Gulf or adapt to changes. With me for the hour, Nick Record with the Bigelow Laboratory, Janet Duffy Anderson with the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, and Damian Brady with UMaine's Darling Marine Center. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. We're going to go to a question here. This is, from Aaron. Aaron asks, I was curious about the influx of different invasive species within the Gulf of Maine. What are some problematic species we are seeing enter this ecosystem, and what can we as a community do to mitigate their impacts? And I love that question, Aaron. We find that question a lot from our audience members. What can I do? And so which one of you wants to answer, Aaron? Go ahead, Nick.
Well, there's so many new arrivals to the Gulf of Maine, and I'll talk about some, and I think probably Damian and Janet will have some to add. But ones that I wanted to highlight, at Bigelow, we focus a lot on the base of the marine food web, and a lot of that is single-celled, often algae. And some algae can be harmful to people or to aquaculture or to marine life. And one of the things that we've seen over the past 10 years or so are new harmful algal species showing up. And sometimes they'll show up for just 1 year and go away, and we don't know why. And other times it seems like they're getting a foothold. So that's definitely something that I'm looking at a lot. Something I'll say in terms of like, how can I get involved is there's all kinds of like community science programs that, I mean, Maine, like you said at the beginning, there's all these organizations doing marine science up and down the coast of Maine. And a lot of localities have great community science programs that people can get involved with. I have one for tracking jellyfish. I know that Gulf of Maine Research Institute has a bunch. Friends of Casco Bay, even local towns up and down the coast have all kinds. So it's easy to get involved. You just have to dig around with what's going on in your neighborhood.
Would you all like to add to that?
I'll just add one of the interesting. So when we think about invasive species, invasive's pretty bad word, right? And you know, what's interesting is to separate climate invaders. You know, as our environment becomes hotter, there are going to be species that are in, let's say, Massachusetts and southern New Hampshire or the mid-Atlantic, like in the case of blue crabs, that are coming up here. In some ways, the best action, of course, is climate, right? For those types of invaders. And then the other types of invaders, which are sort of introduced by us, right? Let's say, you know, we're all familiar with ballast water in large ships that, you know, take up water from the Mediterranean, then end up in the Gulf of Maine, and then discharge that water, that they could introduce a lot of invasive. So there are policies that help with those kinds of invaders, or, you know, checking your boat. If you're going to take your boat from the mid-Atlantic and drive up to Maine and put it in the water here, the kinds of things that we do in lakes. So those are the sort of human policy side of things to treat those types of invasions. And the climate invasion, though, right, is obviously a really tricky problem. And just contributing to addressing climate change is my best answer to that question.
I'm going to go to an email from Joy, which I think is related to this answer that you just gave, Damian. My question is about the impacts of stronger storms and storm surge impacts on coastal properties. It seems that the impacts from storms are increasing, and right now the approach to dealing with them, it seems to be rebuilding after each storm. This doesn't seem very sustainable in the long term, particularly for towns with smaller populations that may not have the funds to continue to manage these impacts. What are the panel's thoughts on how to manage this issue? Is managed retreat something that's even possible? So I know you all are scientists and you're not policymakers, but what would you say to Joy? I'll start with you, Janet.
Yeah, thanks. Great question, Joy. Yeah, we are seeing some pretty significant impacts of climate change on changing coastlines and sea level rise. And we are, you know, a little bit put behind the eight ball in terms of how we're going to be responding to that. So some efforts that are underway are, you know, modeling efforts that identify areas that are particularly at risk. And some things that we can do in order to be able to help mitigate that is, for example, investing energy into marshlands, for example, that absorb some of that storm energy. So looking at our coastline and determining where are some marshlands that we want to make sure that we preserve so that they help mitigate some of that strength that comes from storms that increase the impact of sea level rise. And I'm also looking at some of our working waterfront infrastructure, making sure that our wharves are sufficiently resilient to the effects of climate change, knowing what those predicted sea level rise measures will be, so that we can fortify some of those wharves and working waterfront that we have. And then taking a look at some of our coastal communities and trying to determine where we want to put new development. Are some of the areas that are being scoped for new development, are they in areas that are particularly vulnerable to climate change, and should they be relocated? So I think all of these issues are important for helping us mitigate the effect of sea level rise and climate change, and there are likely others as well.
An email here from Caroline. How does the fact that Maine is so single species focused, the iconic Maine lobster, help and hurt when it comes to adaptations and changes at the same time? Do any of you have some thoughts on lobster and its central role in Maine's economy and how many lobster there are there?
Yeah, I'll just add two things, and I'm sure Nick will too. But I'll just say that the issue there, right, becomes if something was to downturn in the lobster fishery, right, you know, what is it in our working waterfront that people can fall back on? I know a lot of people have spoken about aquaculture. John mentioned before that there are many people trying many different things along the coast, you know, for instance, kelp farming, right? So I think Atlantic Sea Farm has 30 to 35 lobster partners, right? So if lobstering were to downturn, is kelp farming a good alternative for those that are already diversifying their profile of the things that they kind of do? And so I think there is, there's work to diversify our working waterfront. And I'll just add something to Janet said too. We need access on the working waterfront. So the more points of access that fishermen and aquaculturists and growers and people who rely on the coast can have to the coast, the more resilient we'll be from a climate perspective, right? So that's also a policy thing, right, that informs, you know, a piece of resilience. And I'm sure Nick will have something to add to that too.
Nick.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'll just add real quickly, the question the caller or emailer asked, like, how has it helped? I think one of the great things about lobstering in Maine is that while a lot of other fisheries in the Northeast were collapsing, the lobster industry figured out a lot of things about managing a fishery sustainably, and in a lot of ways enacted these measures that they had to on their own. And that narrative has taught a lot of other places about ways to do fishing in sustainable ways. And a big part of that is that we have this owner-operator culture that's tied into our coastal communities. And a lot of other places, you have these top-down approaches that just have not worked really well. So that's one of the positive takeaways, I think, from the way things have developed in the last few decades here.
Janet.
Just to build on that and also kind of to circle back to the concept of resilience. Resilience is not just inherent in our natural systems, but it is inherent in our social and economic systems as well. And key to that is really heterogeneity and diversification. And so, you know, to the caller's point about lobster being, you know, kind of a unique and potentially monolithic fishery, we can really build a lot of resilience into our fisheries culture by having a diversified fisheries portfolio. And we're seeing lots of evidence of that. So lobstermen, for example, who farm kelp in the wintertime or who fish for other species, it's a way of insulating economically and socially from the effects of climate changes to really have a diversified fisheries portfolio.
I want to ask you all about something that I've been seeing a lot lately, I think, especially in national media, when it's in a couple documentaries and also in some print reporting that's happened, is that there's a sort of an offhand assumption that the lobsters are leaving Maine. And just like they did in Connecticut and Massachusetts, and a very unnuanced statement. And I want to ask you all, because I'm sure our listeners have seen the same thing. Is that true, Janet?
Yeah, that's a great question. And unfortunately, we do hear a lot of that. So we know that there are some shifts in lobster population. I think it's important to understand a little bit about lobster biology in order to put a little context around this question. So lobsters, like all species, have thermal preferences. So they have temperatures that they can succeed at. When those temperatures go above sort of whatever their maximum threshold is, they start to do poorly. And what we saw sort of at the southern end of the range, for example, in New York Bight, lobsters were sort of at the edge of their thermal tolerance. And so when there was a change in temperature there, what we saw were die-offs of the lobster fishery. Lobsters in Gulf of Maine are not at that point. They're sort of in the middle of the sweet spot of their temperature tolerance. And so, we have seen an increase in lobster abundance in more recent years. Also, kind of getting to the idea of heterogeneity and refuging, again, Gulf of Maine is quite heterogeneous. We have pockets of cold water here, and it's likely that we will continue to have lobsters, maybe differences in where they're distributed, but it's likely that we will continue to have lobsters in Gulf of Maine. That said, we are seeing shifts in the distribution of lobster. So we're seeing the population now moving out into deeper water, so farther off the coast and into deeper water over the continental shelf. And also the population is moving potentially northward into Canada as well.
So there is a shift, and it sounds like to places that might be more difficult for lobstermen to fish.
Indeed. I mean, we are seeing that lobstermen are having to go farther from shore in order to catch lobsters. They're occurring in areas where historically they didn't before. And in particular, our coastlines, where we have more shallow water, is areas where we see changes in lobster distribution.
Do either of you, Nick or Damien, want to add to this question about lobster? Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, I'll just add real quick, as a forecaster, you know, lobsters leaving the Gulf of Maine is something that scientists have been forecasting since at least the 1970s and maybe earlier. And so far it hasn't come to pass. So I think you always have to take that forecast, that particular one, with a grain of salt. One thing that we are looking out for, which played a role in some of the southern New England collapses, is the epizootic shell disease. It's like a disease that lobsters get when it gets warmer, usually. And right now there's a scientist, Maya Groner, working with DMR to try to answer that question. How close are we to the point where that shell disease could cause some real damage? So stay tuned for the results of that.
Yeah, we just have a couple minutes left, and I'll turn back to you, Nick. That's really interesting. That's something that we're looking out for, is what would be a threat? What's a possible threat? What are you all watching out for? And I'm wondering if there are any others that you would like to add to that list.
Well, like I said, I'm a forecaster, and that is a source of both fear and hope. I think about Octavia Butler, who was just great at imagining these dystopian futures, but who also said just thinking about the future itself is an act of hope. So I'm always thinking about problems, what's coming. And I think we're probably going to be doing this for the next 100 years. I don't know. I'm definitely, with the cold, deep waters, I definitely have my eyes open for potential returns of right whales to historical feeding areas this summer. Cold water doesn't mean it necessarily will happen, but I know DMR is watching it a lot more closely than they have in the past as well. And that's something I'm keeping my eyes open for in particular. And some of these harmful and toxic species is something that we always need to be vigilant for.
And Damien, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I'll give you a number. I'm looking at 20 degrees Celsius, which is, if you're going down to the beach, 68 degrees Fahrenheit. The more, you know, that's sort of the top end for the American lobster, right? So if we're thinking about what the future of this iconic species is, I'm kind of looking when and where is it above 20 degrees Celsius or 68 degrees Fahrenheit a lot. And that's going to be sort of where we're in a situation where we're going to look really hard at that. So, and Nick mentioned this a couple of times, but the Department of Marine Resources, we're very lucky to have this sort of ecosystem of institutions along the coast here. We're extremely lucky to have the Maine Department of Marine Resources, which I think is just one of the best agencies in the country for managing our fisheries and providing resilience, right, to these populations over time.
All right, I'm going to do this to you. Just a few seconds, Janet, what are you got your eye on? What do you have your eye on?
Well, what I would say is that my eye is casting toward the future. For sort of the status of seafood as a whole, what we know is that it's projected that globally the demand for seafood is expected to double by 2050. And reports recently have shown that over 90% of our seafood production, both in aquaculture and fisheries, are threatened by climate-mediated effects. So I have my eye on trying to understand that and looking to Gulf of Maine as a source of resilience for how we can address those changes in the future.
Well, thank you so much. That's Janet Duffy Anderson, Chief Scientific Officer at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Also with us, Damian Brady, Professor of Marine Sciences and Director of the Darling Marine Center with the University of Maine, and Nick Record, Director of Ecosystem Modeling for the Tandy Center for Ocean Forecasting at Bigelow Lab. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.